Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Does a focus on our children's early achievements get in the way of the real work of childhood? We parents can't help but be proud when our kids are promoted to first chair, win medals at their favorite sports, or come in first in spelling bees or math tournaments. But there is a fine line between encouraging them to try their best and pushing them beyond their natural limits into a very stressful existence. And my guest today worries many well-meaning American parents are dragging their exhausted children right over that line. Dr. Madeline Levine is a psychologist, educator, and author of the new book, Teach Your Children Well, Parenting for Authentic Success. Madeline, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris.
You have seen the fallout among your patients of too much focus on early achievements and not enough kid time. What does that fallout look like?
It looks like pretty tired kids, mm-hmm. Some of whom work incredibly hard to keep up. You know, a child doesn't want to do anything more than please their parents. So if they sense that it's really important to the parents, kids will do everything they can to meet their parents' expectations. That's what happens to a lot of kids. And some kids just know they're not going to win the game, and they kind of fold their cards and refuse to play. But what we're seeing is incredibly high rates, depending on which age we're talking about, but incredibly high rates of stress-related symptoms like headaches and stomach aches, but also really worrisome rates of depression in younger and younger kids, anxiety disorders in younger and younger kids, self-mutilation, eating disorders, tragically suicide. So I'm not laying all those things solely at the foot of parental pressure and too much pushing, but they certainly don't help, and they certainly are a contributing factor, because kids have always had some degree of stress. I mean, that's just what life is. But historically, children have said either the greatest stress of in their lives was their parents, you know, fighting, or not being allowed to sit at the lunch table, you know, peers. But now, by far, the greatest stress in children's lives, whether they're trying to get into Harvard or just trying to pass the high school exit exam, is school.
And I guess this sense that nothing is good enough unless they are number one, unless they win the tournament, it leaves them sort of ill-prepared to deal with the inevitable failures and mistakes they will make once they've left our homes.
Well, yes, and also, I mean, I can't help but I'm smiling on the other end of the line because it's kind of like to be number one, there's only one number one, right? and so this notion that kids should be the best at things. You know, the Olympics is going on. I was just listening to something before you and I got on the phone together, and it's like, here you are, you get the bronze, right? You're the third best in the world in something, and it's not good enough, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that's how a lot of kids feel, is they put their best effort into something, they do well, and that's not good enough. And it's I feel like adults have a secret, Chris, from kids. And that secret is this, that even though we push our kids to be straight A's and, you know, captain of the soccer team and stuff like that, in real life, I'm a basketball fan, you go to your right, you go to your strength. So I'm having fun talking to you on the phone. I enjoy it. It's easy for me. But if I have to go to a speaking engagement later, I need a GPS and a MapQuest and my husband on quick dial because I'm going to get lost.
Oh, my gosh. I'm exactly in that place. Yes.
Right? Sometimes I think there must be something with verbal skills and spatial skills. They just don't seem to go together well. But so I didn't become a surgeon, right?
Yeah.
You didn't become a surgeon. You did where your strengths were. And so this business about somebody was just telling me an hour ago about a kid who had a single C on that transcript and apparently wasn't hired by Google or something. And it's like, you know, that's just not the way the world works. We're very good, if we're lucky, at one or two things. We're pretty average at a whole bunch of things, and we're not very good at other things. And so to communicate to kids that who have less experience, less judgment, that they're supposed to be good at every, not good, great at everything, is incredibly unrealistic, and I think sets them up for tremendous disappointment.
You know, we talked about this briefly last week when we had David Marinus on with his new biography of President Obama. Mm-hmm. And regardless of anyone's politics, people will agree that he is a very high-achieving individual. Mm-hmm. He was not a great student in elementary school, in high school, his first 2 years of college. He was just average.
Right. And Michael Jordan was cut from his high school basketball team. Hmm. So, you know, this notion that you can predict from early, and with President Obama, it's not that early, that you can predict somebody's life course by looking at the metrics of their life early on is it's just inaccurate. So you have parents trying to decide, should we put our children in academic preschools or play-based preschools? And the idea is, well, if they're in an academic preschool, they'll have a leg up and therefore they'll do better. But in fact, kids who are in play-based preschools down the road academically do better. There was, you know, Baby Einstein, which was so popular. You may have heard this already. You know, so popular, one out of three households in America with a child had a Baby Einstein video. The only problem was that it actually retarded language acquisition by 10% in babies and toddlers. And you know, we didn't find this out for many, many, many years, because the researchers at the University of Washington, of course, don't have the financial resources that Disney has. And so it took decades until Disney had to take the word educational off and offer money back and stuff like that. So there's this idea that if kids look great early on, that they're set for life, but it's not particularly predictive. And I think people who do great in life find something that they love, and then they become really good at it. And that the amount of time that that takes for a child is very, very variable. And it's very variable, particularly because right now our culture says there's like five things that are good for you to do.
Right.
And you know, the other 150 things that you guys are interested in, forget about it. So I have just a short story that I love. I started this, co-founded an organization at Stanford called Challenge Success. And, you know, we're trying to broaden definitions of success. We're in about 100 schools. And my co-founder, Denise, is sitting in the Stanford cafeteria next to a kid, and he knows we started Challenge Success. So he says, oh, I have a great story for you. And he tells her about how he failed out of Catholic school. You have to work pretty hard to fail out of Catholic school, but he did. Got a GED, went to community college, failed out of that, worked in his father's furniture business. That didn't work, so he went back to community college. And so now he's, you know, like 5 years later, and he finds a teacher who says to him, you know, I think you've got a talent for chemistry, and starts mentoring him and working with him. And, you know, long story short, he ends up studying for his PhD at Stanford in chemistry. And so my co-founder says, oh, my God, what a great story. You know, can we use that as an illustration? And he says, yeah, you can use my story, but come back to my department. I have an entire department of kids just like me.
Hmm.
Which means he's not really an outlier,
yeah.
You know, that this, Dimitri Martin has this fabulous cartoon where he says what people think success looks like, you know, and it's a straight line up, and then what success really looks like, and it's a squiggly winding kind of thing, which I think is what success is for the majority of people.
Well, let's talk about school success, because there was a time, I think, when we were kids, when a C grade really was considered average, for the most part acceptable, a B was above average, and an A was really special.
Right.
For a lot of American families right now, an A is the only acceptable grade, and a B will launch, like, tutoring and a whole phalanx of people trying to help this child.
Right. And so, I mean, here is the tough fact, I think, behind that, and that's that parents have become so over-invested in their children's success, and we can talk about that afterwards, that they would rather hear that their child has a deficit than that they're a C student. And, you know, as a psychologist, I have a lot of firsthand experience with this, of parents who go from psychologist to psychologist trying to get some kind of diagnosis, which in the, you know, when I started practicing 25 years ago, you did everything you could to avoid a diagnosis. Now, because you get extra time on the SATs, and also because it gives a reason for why your child is a B or a C student, parents want a diagnosis, and if they can't get a diagnosis, you know, gosh darn it, then they're going to get a tutor to bring that grade up, when in reality, you know, most kids are not A students, say, in math. But that's for some reason, a bitter pill for many parents, and that's really unfortunate, because all it does is make kids feel really bad about themselves. You know, especially, I just kept, literally last night, midnight, came back from New York, and tutors there, high-end tutors at some of the high-end private schools, are $1,000 an hour.
Wow.
Is that mind-blowing?
Yeah,
it's like, let's all quit our jobs.
No, it's, what can they tell you in $1,000? You should up your own rates.
It's just, and I know it's accurate because I spoke to school heads. So what does it mean for a kid whose parents, you know, have 3 hours of tutoring a week, so they're spending $12,000 a month to bring their kid mostly from an A-minus to an A? You know, the message behind that, I think, is just an incredibly toxic one. You can't do it on your own. You're really good, but that's not good enough. And you can't manage without us, and you need enormous resource. I mean, every message it sends is not the kind of message you want if you care about things like character and sense of self and being able to collaborate with other people and all those kinds of things that I think are very important, as do the majority of CEOs in this country.
Madeline, what about parents who say, we're just looking to find the difference and know the difference between whether or not my child is working to his or her potential and whether they are, in fact, phoning it in and not paying enough attention and not applying themselves to a reasonable level?
So I think the way I feel about that is, I don't believe really actually that kids are lazy. I mean, temperamentally, kids have different levels of enthusiasm and activation and stuff like that. But when people come to me with a kid and they say he's lazy, I just figure nobody's speaking his language yet. Mm. And you know, like you said early on, we're really proud when you introduced me, if our kid, you know, gets a trophy or a high grade. We're not so proud when our kid comes home covered with mud, you know, with a lizard that he found at the creek or something. And we should be, because what you want is engagement with learning. And that can take any form. One of my kid's best friends was like this fern freak when he was a kid. Hmm. And he used to just go and collect ferns, and like all the boys, you know, they were all friends, but they thought this was like the weirdest thing, right? They're all out playing basketball and he's collecting ferns. Well, you know, he teaches whatever fernology at one of the biggest, most prestigious universities in the country now. So, you know, tremendous differences of interest, and we ought to be paying attention and celebrating more of them.
My guest is psychologist Dr. Madeline Levine. Her new book is called Teach Your Children Well, Parenting for Authentic Success. We'll come back to the conversation in a moment. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can study a variety of topics such as creative writing, human rights, and the arts. More at smu.edu/MLS.
Yeah. You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is psychologist, consultant, and educator Dr. Madeline Levine. Her new book is called Teach Your Children Well, Parenting for Authentic Success. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Madeline, you devote a fair amount of this book to explaining the tasks of school-age children in elementary school and in middle school and in high school that have nothing to do with academics. And they're fascinating to me because nothing in these chapters can be measured on a standardized test or included in a college essay. This is just the stuff of real life.
Right. And, you know, it's funny. Somebody earlier had asked me about, well, couldn't we have a metrics for all of these things that I write about, you know, like relaxing and downtime and family time and getting used to your new body and, you know, just all the jobs that it takes to grow up. And it's like, not that I'm aware of, you know, because there are so many individual differences. And, you know, we're such a metric-driven kind of country. Like, if you can measure it, it's good. And if you can't, how do you know if you're doing a good job or not?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that goes back to the issue which is probably closest to my heart, which is you have to really know your child.
Yeah.
You have to be able to see the child in front of you. And, you know, if you happen to have the child who's got your temperament and got your drive and, you know, thinks like you, that's a pretty easy job. But most of us have different kinds of children. And, you know, my home was kind of a living laboratory because my oldest kid was a very analytic, you know, kind of straight-A jockey kid, and high school was great for him. My middle kid was very, very creative, also a good student. Not as great for him because the arts are not considered on a par with the sciences. Mm-hmm. And my third kid was a total hands-on kid, and so nothing he was good at counted in school. And I was remembering back to my day, which is quite a while ago, when your report card was divided in half, right? And one side of it was your academic grades, and the other side of it was respects the rights of others, plays well with others. It had a whole bunch of Are you too young for this?
No, I remember very well because it was called deportment, I think, in my elementary school report card, but it also talked about the subcategories, yeah.
Right. And, like, you realize that in a short period of time, that has disappeared.
Hmm.
It doesn't exist anymore. The concept that of equal importance when I'm telling you about your child is what kind of person they are, is how they treat other people, is their sense of self, is their integrity. That's gone. And all we have in its place is every once in a while, you know, like they just did at Stuyvesant in New York, they find a bunch of kids cheating and everybody gets hysterical. As if we didn't know. I mean, we have the data on cheating. We know that depending on how you measure it, anywhere from 75% to 95% of students cheat.
Hmm.
So, you know, so we have sort of ignored the things that we can't measure. I think very much to, you know, to bad outcomes.
So what happened here, Madeline? Because I think, you know, you and I will assume for you that we feel like we turned out okay, despite
right.
the differences in our education with what's available now. Why don't we trust the way it worked for us, for our own children?
That's a great question. I've spent 8 years trying to find the answer to it. I think, you know, I have to tell you, Chris, that I don't have the full answer. I mm-hmm. think I have a partial answer. And the reason that it's hard to get the full answer is, like many complicated social changes, it's vector forces and a whole bunch of things came together. So I think the things that came together that changed the culture were things like you had the dot-com boom where all of a sudden everybody could be a millionaire, you know. You were taking stock tips from your florist and your shoemaker because all of a sudden they were making millions of dollars.
For about 45 minutes, but yes.
Right, right. But that, you know, and then there was the movie Wall Street and you know, greed is good. And then along with that period of time where money was flowing very freely, the media changed focus from, you know, Leave It to Beaver kinds of programs to The Simpsons, where adults were idiots and kids ran the show. You had a little bit later Cribs and Pimp My Ride, and a little after that, My Super Sweet 16. I mean, it was all about materialism. So mm-hmm. the country turned from, you know, people, I want to take a step back. People always say that this country is, the American dream is about wealth, but it really never was about wealth. If you go back to the Horatio Alger story, mm-hmm. it wasn't about becoming rich. It was becoming an upstanding middle-class citizen. That's what his stories were about. And that was the American dream, was to be a good citizen, financially stable, a pillar of the community in the middle class. So I don't think we had, we certainly have had, you know, very wealthy people running the country in the industrial age, but the dream was to become an upstanding citizen, financially secure. And so you have the dot-com, you have the shift in the media, and then you start having tremendous anxiety over globalization and the flat world, and are we keeping up? And I think what was different about this go-around and, say, when we were I'm not sure about you. You sound younger than me, but
I'm 41.
You are younger than me. We had, in my generation, there was Sputnik when I was in elementary school, and that was a similar thing, like we're falling behind, we're not going to keep up, we got to work harder, but it was very collaborative. You know, I don't remember that as anything other than we Americans have to work harder. You know, back then it was because the Ruskies are going to get the space before us, and that's not the zeitgeist now. Now it's basically, you know, you get straight A's. I don't care how you do it. You know, was it the Times that just ran that article? 30% of kids are taking Adderall, ADHD medications, not under a doctor's care, a potentially lethal drug because it produces arrhythmias, so that they can stay up and study. So it's kind of like every man for himself, which was a very different sense than I think other times where the country was in crisis and pulled together. So, you know, and women went to work, and I count myself among them, and didn't really have much of a clue because we were the first generation to go out en masse about whether what we needed in the workplace translated to parenting skills, so we sort of professionalized parenting. Some of the workplace skills apply to raising a family, and some don't at all. So I just think it was a perfect storm. Many of these things came together, you know, with this unfortunate outcome.
Let's go to the phones now. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. We have Joshua on the line in Garland. Hey, Joshua.
Hello, Karen. How are you? And Miss Madeline, hello to you. Karen, we love your show. You've done great for a fellow New Yorker. I'm a fellow New Yorker. I'm here at my summer home in Garland. Your show today is a dream come true, educators in the state of Texas. In fact, Miss Madeline, what are the chances we get you to go to Austin and a joint session with the legislature, lock the doors, and they don't get to leave the room until they hear you because you're in your right mind?
Thank you. Thank you, Joshua.
Required listening. It is so refreshing and exhilarating, your show today, Karen. I just called one of my teacher friends while ago to turn your FM dial to 90.1. Quick, hang up.
Well, thank you so much for your call, Joshua. It's Chris, by the way, but thank you. I really appreciate your call. I want to ask you this, Madeline, because I'm sure you hear from people who say, thank goodness, I really relate to this. Do you also, I mean, you wouldn't have to write this book if there weren't parents who got a little icy and a little uncomfortable and said, well, that's not my family, and my child is stressed out for some other reason.
Yeah, I just came back from Washington, D.C. and was talking at a bookstore called Politics and Prose that's pretty well known. And some women just, you know, excoriated me around, you know, not understanding how she was a great parent. And, you know, she felt very attacked by what I was saying and that parents try the best they can. And I was out of touch. And I got to tell you, it happens very, very rarely now. So it's very fresh in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm a mom of three, and I worked, and while I raised my children, I can't tell you how sympathetic I am to the dilemmas that women face in this country. We are not in any way set up to aid or help mothers who are trying to work and raise their children. We don't have any of the social structure or infrastructure in place. So usually I'm told that I've got a soft touch with women. But yes, you know, people, I mean, part of what I'm saying, of course, Chris, is that people project onto their children. Everybody in this family went to Harvard.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody in this family is a doctor. I once got this hysterical phone call from a mom, I mean, sobbing her kid didn't get into Michigan, and she's like, he won't be a Wolverine. I had to Google it really fast. and I said, you know, you go sit down, take a breath, let me talk to your kid for a minute. And the kid gets on, and he's like, you know, my mother's whacked. I never wanted to go to Michigan. I'm going to Wisconsin, and I'm happy as can be. I just got in.
Hmm.
So this had nothing to do with the kid. It had to do with the mom's aspirations. And I think, unfortunately, for very complicated reasons, I think we're isolated and people feel alone, and so we kind of throw our lot in with our children,
mm-hmm.
In ways that aren't always the best.
Well, earlier you mentioned this professionalism, professionalizing of parenthood, and I definitely think this is true for women of my generation and men as well. But I think moms sometimes fall victim to this more easily than dads. But talk about this, because there's a certain kind of peer pressure among parents to have high achieving children.
Well, there is, and you know. If you read between the lines of this book or The Price of Privilege, they're not about children. The books are about parents.
Mm-hmm.
But it's very hard. You know, in psychology, the old saw is you take people where they are. And right now where the culture is and where parents are is what's happening to our children. The real question is what's happening to our parents.
Mm.
And why their levels of anxiety are so incredibly high, why they project so much onto their children, why they're willing to lead these completely child-centric lives. It's interesting to me that I can actually get a round of applause or, like Joshua, a lot of enthusiasm on the academic side of things.
Mm-hmm.
But when I say I don't like traveling teams, especially in the Midwest, it's dead silence.
Yeah.
And it's not that I don't like traveling teams. I don't like the fact that, having had three boys, that every weekend I felt the pressure to be with all the other parents at every single game that my kids played in. And because I had two in traveling teams, my husband was in one part of California and I was in another part of California. And in retrospect, you know, if your listeners take anything away, in retrospect, think about what else you might do with some of that time. So you might spend it with your spouse or your partner. You might spend it with a friend. You might read that book you've been meaning to read. You might do some volunteer work. The idea that parents spend all their time in child-centric activities, I think, for kids, makes growing up look incredibly unappealing. You work your bottom off all week long, and then you sit passively in the stands while a bunch of kids throw a ball around. And I think that has something to do with why kids are in no rush to grow up, because one of our jobs is to present a really appealing picture of growing up. Like, right when you were 5, you couldn't wait till you were 10. When you were 10, you couldn't wait till you were 15. But I can't tell you how many kids have said, you know, really? I've got it pretty good now. I'm sort of college-age kids. I'm not sure I want to play that game. It doesn't seem very appealing to them.
So when you say let your kids go outside and play, it means you go outside and play as well and let them see that there's something to look forward to.
Absolutely. I never understood why, through 8 trillion soccer and lacrosse games, why the parents didn't, you know, go off on the side and have our own game.
Mm-hmm.
Right? If you flip it around, you can see how absurd it is. You would never think of saying to your children, you know, I'm really trying to get better at folding the laundry or, folding the laundry. So, like, every Saturday morning, we're all going to sit and watch me fold laundry, right?
Cheer for, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So why do we spend, you know, half of our weekend, our free time is so precious, and I'm not saying never go, because there is a sense of community, and since we have so little sense of community, and some kids like it and some kids don't. But you had asked about peer pressure. I think the peer pressure is what's driving, you know, people think about peer pressure as teenagers.
Right.
But we're social animals. There's peer pressure all of our lives.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Jackie in Arlington. Hey, Jackie.
Hi, Chris. I'm a pre-K teacher in a public school in Arlington, and we just had our annual conference, and we are all totally supportive of Dr. Levine and the play-based classroom, but our central administration thinks we ought to be academically based, and we're constantly struggling is how do we communicate that as teachers to our administration that the play-based curriculum is what's going to give our children the foundation they need to learn later in life?
Yeah. Teachers, just a general shout out to teachers who probably have the toughest job of anybody right now. In the middle of this kind of sort of bifurcation of, you know, are we going to go all academics or are we going to just let kids play? I don't know your administration, so I'm not sure specifically what they might be interested in, Jackie, but I think, you know, schools are supposed to be collaborative endeavors, right? So it should be administration, teachers, and parents. So are the parents at your school any more sympathetic than the administration is?
Let's come back to this. Jackie, stay on the line. We will get an answer to that in a moment, and we will take a quick break first. My guest is psychologist Dr. Madeline Levine. Her new book is called Teach Your Children Well, Parenting for Authentic Success. If you'd like to join us, the number is 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with psychologist, consultant, and educator Dr. Madeline Levine, whose new book is called Teach Your Children Well, Parenting for Authentic Success. Before the break, we began our conversation with Jackie in Arlington. And Jackie, are the parents at the school where you teach interested in a more play-based curriculum? Are they supportive of that?
Some of them are, but a lot of our parents are working class parents, and they want their kids to get ahead, and they think to get ahead we've got to be very academically based so that they'll learn everything they need to know to get ahead.
What do you think, Madeline?
Yeah, I mean, this is a not an unusual problem, and you know, I think it's a matter of education where you have to bring somebody in. I was just in Arlington, so hi back to Arlington. You have to bring somebody in. You have to get a group of people together to start educating people, because the point, which obviously you know, Jackie, is that if you want your kids to do well, you need to look at development and how development proceeds. And if you get in the way of development by forcing kids to read early or not allowing them to play, which is really how they learn, they will do less well. So, you know, it can be a very tough sell initially, but I think once parents sort of get the idea that the best way to make their children successful is to listen to the developmental research, and your administration should know better because they do know the research. So I think you go in with a group of like-minded teachers and say, you know, what's the justification for running things out of sync with everything we know about child development? And I wish you good luck, because I know it can be very challenging.
How surprised are moms and dads when you reveal to them that their star oboe player or tennis champion or whatever wants to quit?
Well, they're usually not happy campers when that happens. Although I think parents are always surprised. One of the things we do at Challenge Success, for example, is look at a kid's schedule. And if, you know, we have a 24-hour time wheel, and we insist that there's adequate sleep, playtime, downtime, family time. So that leaves a certain amount of time left, which means a lot of families have to, who are interested in this, have to take a look with their child at the schedule and say, okay, you know, you've got 6 hours of extracurriculars. That's not working because you can't get enough sleep. What do you want to cut out? And parents are often shocked at what the child chooses to cut out. So the child will say, well, you know, I don't want to take my ballet lessons anymore. And mom goes, what? You know, that's your greatest strength. You're a fabulous ballerina. And the kid, you know, has gone to ballet lessons every week because mom wanted her to, and it's kind of fun. But really, she'd actually rather lay on her bed and talk to her friends or read a book or whatever. So, again, it's, you know, it's kind of like not having any respect for children's intuitive sense of who they are. And of course, kids need tremendous guidance and tremendous help, and they don't have the judgment, they don't have the experience. But they also, that's their job, is to craft the person, the internal person they're going to be. And we're so busy telling them what to do that all they get to craft is a performance-based persona, you know, what other people expect of them. And they're really quite lost around what they feel internally.
And haven't helped the kid who hasn't yet figured out what he or she loves to do. You write about the fact that it's okay for kids to be enthusiastic about something, but not necessarily have a passion for anything. In fact, that's probably more common than not.
Right. Thank you. Thanks for bringing that up. I mean, you know, it is really quite extraordinary to have an upset mother sitting talking to me about her child's lack of passion and what is she going to do, and everybody and her other children have passion, and then you say, well, you know, exactly how old is your child? And she says 6. So, you know, I used to like the word passion. Now I don't. It's just one more stressor. I mean, can you imagine saying to a 6-year-old, what's your passion? The passion of a 6-year-old should be life, playing, being outdoors, running around. And it's just silly to think that the majority of kids will be passionate at 6. Their job, their developmental job in elementary school is to do lots of different things so that they can figure out actually what they do like.
So how do we nurture what they are interested in without giving in to the temptation to sort of push too hard?
Well, you know, I always say, like, you already went to college. It's these parents who are so upset about college or high school or whatever, we're not night teachers. Teachers get paid, and they have, like I said before, the toughest job in America as far as I'm concerned. We're not the night teacher. We're not, you know, there are parents who spend hours every night going over their kids' homework. You have to trust a little bit that there's an education system in place and that you are not doing your child a favor by exhausting them. The research on sleep is just becoming astoundingly clear about the negative effects of too little sleep. And the American Academy of Pediatrics says 9 hours and 15 minutes if your kid's in high school, 10 hours if your kid is in junior high school, 11 hours if she's in elementary school, she or he. And instead, our high school kids are not getting 7 hours. So they've got over a 2-hour deficit every single night. And We know it's tied to poorer concentration, inability to transfer into long-term memory, increased risk of depression, just a whole bunch of stuff. And I think at the end of the day, Chris, the thing that stuns me is when my kids were younger and they sprayed chemicals on the apples at the local Safeway, we were all out with signs and picketing and chanting, you know, don't poison our children. And I'm not sure what happened to that sort of sensibility of protectiveness around things like this. I mean, there isn't a school in this country that hasn't had tragedy or high levels of emotional problems or cheating or, you know, there are no schools anymore that don't see this. You asked me before, do I, you know, sometimes get blowback? And I did 6 years ago. I very rarely do now because most people are aware that the toll is unsustainable for kids.
So since this book is about parents as much as kids, what sort of baby steps do you recommend to moms and dads who realize maybe they need to let up a little bit but don't know, have no idea how to start doing that?
So in the book, I hate exercises in books. I've never completed one, and I think I say in the book, I know, I hate exercises too. There's a series of exercises around figuring out really what you value, and then how do you actually implement that in your life. So if you say that you value health, and, you know, it takes you through the steps of looking at how you implement things, implement the value of healthy living into parenting. I actually think that the best thing parents could do is take some time for themselves and figure out what is driving their preoccupation with their children's performance. Because I think until we understand individually what drives us, it's really hard to make changes. And once we understand it, it's much easier. Just very quickly, I told you my youngest kid, you know, is a hands-on kid, and he didn't get the grades his brother got, and he came home with a good grade, and then it dropped, and I gave him a really hard time. He's crying. I'm crying. I mean, it was horrible. And it's the kind of mistake we all make from time to time.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had to go and figure out what the heck I was doing. Lord knows I should know better. You know, and I realized that it had to do with part of my history, which was, you know, my dad died when he was very young, and I got to go to college on a scholarship course. My verbal skills were good, and this was an English class that his grade dropped. And so in that moment, I wasn't seeing him at all. I was just remembering what it felt like when I was terrified that if my grades in English dropped, you know, I wouldn't get to college. Mm-hmm. And I think whenever we act kind of crazy with our kids or over-invested or over-involved, it ties back to some disappointment or loss or hurt in our own lives. And I think we need to figure those things out. And you know, because you always want something specific as a takeaway, I think, you know, you do something like commit to having dinner together 5 times a week. Research is overwhelming. You know, cuts down pregnancy, increases academic achievement. I don't think it has to be dinner, but I think there has to be some time every day when you and your family get together and just hang out together. And, you know, was when we did this every night, was the conversation amazingly stimulating every night with three boys? Absolutely not. but it was sometimes, mm-hmm. and it was a time set aside to come together as a family and to hear out whoever was dealing with something. So I think that's, you know, that's the first baby step, and the other one would be really make sure your kid gets a decent night's sleep.
Let's go to the phones one last time here. We have Barbara on the line in Carrollton. Hi, Barbara.
Hi. Yeah, I had a comment. I have had four children. They're big now. And the biggest problem I had along these lines was really with the schools.
Uh-huh.
Because you would get people saying, like, your son, like, one of my sons was really good at math. And they'd say, oh, the teacher would say, oh, but this other child is better. And I'd say, that's nice. He's very nice. I like his mom, but I mean, they were always to talk about the comparing and the pushing and the telling you it wasn't good, you know, that they should do more and more and more and more. That's where I found, no matter how good they were, it was usually the schools and or the teachers that I would find that I had the most problem with in terms of toning down.
Right. So, you know, the dilemma with this whole issue is if I talk to a bunch of teachers, they tell me it's the parents. If I talk to the parents, they point their fingers at the teachers. And if I talk to parents and teachers together, they point their finger at the universities. So, no, really, that's the way it goes.
Uh-huh.
So it's everybody's problem. And everybody plays a role in it. And, you know, you gave a nice example just now of what I think this whole issue is actually about, and that's the courage to stand up and for each and every one of us and protect our kids the way moms have always protected their kids and sort of have a voice and say, please don't compare my child, or if you're a teacher to say, you know, you can't call me at 11 o'clock at night, or if you're the administrator to say, we are rethinking this in light of the research. So everybody has their own work to do, and everybody has had a hand in this, and I think it just takes an enormous amount of courage to kind of swim against the stream.
Speaking of swimming, I was actually watching swimming in the Olympics last night, and you know, you see the Americans win, and they show their mothers, and you think about all the mornings they get up at 4 a.m. to take
right.
their kids. I mean, does this sort of pressure tend to get worse? It might sound like a silly question, but in Olympic years, when the stories of all these young men and women who've been so successful inevitably include their parents who were just so dedicated.
Right. So, you know, you're talking about the slimmest group, once again, it's sort of like, I guess, like loss of perspective, Chris.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you've got a couple hundred kids out of the entire country. You know, the preoccupation with sports, in I was looking the numbers up last night. In reality, the number of kids who play high school sports and then go on to play at a professional level or an Olympic level is 0.03%.
Wow.
So, and the number that just go to play sports in college is 3%, and then that go on after that. So, you know, we're talking about a tiny group of incredibly talented kids, and it's interesting what struck you. What strikes me is you come in gold, silver, or bronze. You're the third best person in the world in something, and somehow that doesn't really feel all that good, right?
Yeah, you come back in 4 years and really make it count.
Right, right. it's crazy, yeah.
Madeline Levine is a psychologist, educator, and author of the new book, Teach Your Children Well, Parenting for Authentic Success. Madeline, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Oh, thank you, Chris. It was great.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bilotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is senior producer of Think. You can learn more about the show, find out about upcoming programs, and download the free daily podcast online at kera.org/think. If you've got comments, questions, or suggestions, you can send those along to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.